You're listening to the Book Talk Today podcast, a podcast that inspires readers to obtain valuable insights to inform, educate, and improve lives. My name is Orhan Abdi. I'm an avid reader, best known for the creation of the 1 Minute Book Review community, and I'm sitting down with authors to delve deeper into the books they have written to uncover the story behind the story. Today we are joined by Tom Rivett-Karnack. Tom is the founding partner at Global Optimism and host of the Outrage and Optimism podcast. He is a political strategist focused on a better future, and he is here to discuss his co-authored book, The Future We Choose, The Stubborn Optimist's Guide to the Climate Crisis. Tom, it's a pleasure to have you on.
It's wonderful to be here. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. So climate change is very much in today's news. Over the past 50 years, obviously, everyone is on a sustainability kick. Probably not the right word.
I'm very glad to hear that, by the way. So that's good news for everybody.
Yeah, I think everyone's definitely got it in their minds that we need to be more conscious about everything that we do, whether it's the things that we consume or, for instance, the transport that we use. So I think it'd be good, in light of the book, for those that haven't read it, to just outline what it means to be an optimist in light of all the ecological disasters that are happening at the moment and climate change in general. How can we be an optimist?
No, so it's a great question. And I mean, you know, you can look at this and say, well, this is such a difficult, intractable problem. Isn't it irresponsible to be an optimist in the face of what is clearly a rapidly unfolding emergency? So let me kind of take you inside our thinking, because it's a really central part of the book. And actually what we say is we want everyone to be a stubborn optimist in relation to this. Now, what do we mean by that? What we don't mean is that we need to ignore the reality that we're facing. As we set out clearly in the book with some, you know, some fairly alarming scenarios that we're facing, we need to reduce emissions by fully 50% inside this decade, or we will lose control of the climatic system and all of the devastating impacts that will lead to for people, for ecosystems, and for future generations. Now, in the face of that, and accepting the reality that no one's coming along to save us from this disaster, either we're going to figure it out or it's going to be as bad as we expect that it could be, what's the right attitude that we bring to that? We should not ignore that reality. That would be deeply irresponsible. But at the same time, if I say to you, we have 10 years to reduce emissions by 50% or we're going to lose control of the system, most people have this little frisson of fear that kind of happens to them. They're like, oh my God, we're not going to make it. What's the future going to be like? What's my life going to be like? What are my children's lives going to be like? That is an entirely understandable response. But what we set out in the book is that's kind of part of our problem. What we face now is an enormous privilege, an enormous opportunity. Those of us who are here now will have more of an impact on life on Earth in the future than any generation that has previously existed. What we do in the next 10 years, these 10 years will be thought about and read about and looked over for hundreds of years to come, either for a very positive reason, because we did it, or with a degree of serious resentment and well-placed resentment, because we didn't. And what remains of the human race will be thinking back to that time. We live at that fulcrum. And what do you do at that moment? Actually, what we say is if you look back at history, this sense of a stubborn and gritty and determined and realistic optimism is what has pulled us through these dark moments, right? Think back to moments like, you know, Fight Them on the Beaches, or I Have a Dream, or the suffragette marches, or Gandhi's salt marches to the beach. These were really dark moments when an outcome was far from certain, but individuals stood up and said, we refuse to accept that it is beyond our ability to deal with the problems that we've created. And we will, you know, it looked unlikely that they were going to be successful, but they weren't cowed by that. They kept going. And that stubborn, determined optimism, what we learned, because the book partly tells the story of the Paris Agreement that Christiana and Figueres and I were involved in, what we realized in that process of creating the Paris Agreement is that that stubborn and determined optimism was not the result of success. It was the cause of it. And actually, if you go back into it, the attitude changed first and that changed the outcome. So we try to say, let's get our arms around the enormity and the privilege of this moment. Let's enjoy it. Let's face it and let's embrace it and let's really do it with a bit of energy and determination. The fear is there. It will always be there, but it doesn't have to define us. This is a privilege. Let's get to it. Let's make it count.
Definitely. And I think the subtext of the book was definitely the Paris Agreement and your inclusion and your work within it. So I think it'd be good for those that are listening that don't know the details about it to just give an introduction to why it was such a massive step in the right direction.
Sure. No, and the thing about the Paris Agreement that I would say straight away is that it was a massive step, and it was a huge step forward, and it's nowhere near enough. And that's actually kind of a common theme in the world of climate change. So Christiana hired me to come and work with her. She was the executive secretary of the UN Climate Convention. She hired me to come and run political strategy for her. And the responsibility that she had and that I supported her on was to get 195 countries to unanimous agreement on climate change. Now, that was extremely difficult and had been very difficult for decades, right? Countries had never really come together and agreed this. It's very hard to agree to something that is long-term, that might affect economies. And actually what we ended up with was all the countries saying, this is a bad thing. We don't want to take action on climate change. We want to keep polluting. We want to keep emitting fossil fuels because it's good for our people. Now, the Paris Agreement did bring every country together in a legally binding international treaty. And the way that that was done was to flip the structure of the agreement. Before, all countries would come together and they would agree what the emissions reductions that they would all take would be. Very hard negotiations. They'd then go back to their national countries and they'd try and pass laws that would implement what they'd agreed at the UN. And many times they were unable to pass those laws. I mean, most famously, Al Gore agreed to the Kyoto Protocol, went home, and he couldn't get a law through the Senate. So it made a mockery of all of this international effort when they couldn't be implemented at home. What we did with the Paris Agreement, and this is part of the root of the optimism, and we can get into this, is we gave it two parts instead. One, a long-term goal by 2050 to really solve it that was everyone's collective effort. And in between now and 2050, a commitment from each country to come back to the table with a nationally determined 5-year commitment. And they'd come back every 5 years and set the next 5 years and set the next 5 years. What that meant was that each country could say, here's my contribution. I might be a forest country in Africa, and I'm going to not cut my forest down and do it this way. So it was nationally determined. It was good for them as a country. Another country that burnt a lot of coal could say, well, we'll reduce coal and we'll get cleaner air and healthier people at the same time. And as a result of that, the fact that it was nationally determined, no one was telling them what to do. They could work out what was going to happen for themselves, you know, with some oversight from the international community. What that meant was that every country, almost every country, came with a meaningful commitment. And we're now seeing 2021, big negotiation in Glasgow at the end of the year, what the next round of commitments under the Paris Agreement will be.
Definitely. And I think in the book you gave a great bit at the end where you talked about what we can do like today and tomorrow and next week and in 2030 and 2050. So it's really asking the individual in that context as countries, which is a lot more difficult than the individual, perhaps.
Well, I mean, on that, you know, and we'll maybe get into this, but I'm old enough now, I'm in my early 40s and I've been working on this for kind of 20 years. I'm old enough to have seen a few cycles of, like, for a while everyone says it's all about individuals, it all has to be individual action, and then that's kind of a bit of a struggle, we don't quite get to where you need to be, and a few years later it's all about corporations or it's all about investors and then back to individuals. It's got to be all of it. This is the decade, right? It has to be all levels of society, governments, investors, civil society, cities, schools, individuals. All of society approach. No one group or no one set of entities can solve this.
I just finished the book 21 Lessons for the 21st Century by Yuval Noah Harari, and I know he gives a quote about the book and how good the book is. It was interesting there. He said that ecological, let's say, policies or the importance of ecological maintenance can't happen in the current liberal state and liberal democracies that we have, because it's all about free markets, and free markets basically mean that it's all about economic growth. And I think in Action 7, I think you said in the book, you said about how we need to be investing in a clean economy. So do you think it's, I know it's probably just one part of the puzzle when it says a change in how we see the economy, but that must have been one of the biggest hurdles to the Paris Agreement, where you have these countries that are using these fossil fuels in order to actually get their people out of perhaps poverty or just grow their economy in general?
No, it's a great question. So a couple of answers to that. One is, part of the reason why we're now making so much progress on climate, and we are, again, huge, massive progress, not enough, but we're making massive progress, is because the solutions to climate change are now more beneficial economically than the causes. So actually, solar and wind are the cheapest forms of new power in most places around the world. And what's more, not only do you not cook the planet, but your population doesn't die of terrible air pollution and all these other different issues that come along with that. Now, I do think that if you look into the climate change debate, there can be these camps that emerge, right? One camp can say, we need to look at the system we've got and deploy capital within the capitalistic system towards the solutions, and that's how we're going to solve it. And the other camp says, no, the problem is the underlying structure of capitalism, and we need to change the rules of capitalism, etc. And the absurdity is that those two can kind of fight with each other, even though they both sort of have the same endpoint in mind. I tend to see them as a bit of a continuum instead. And both Christiana and I, something that brings us together is we're pragmatists. So right now, today, this is the world we've got. Let's use it, and let's use all the tools we have available, and those do include innovation, entrepreneurship, investment, capital markets, to start moving us towards the solutions we need. Now, is it true that ultimately capitalism probably isn't serving humanity? It's kind of making us miserable, and it's facilitating extraction of the world and seeing the world as a bunch of resources rather than a living web of life? Yes, and we probably have to deal with that too. But I don't see those two things as separate. I think there's a bunch of stuff we can do when we wake up in the morning to do with changing the economy now and meeting this emergency. And there's a bunch of other stuff that we need to think about and write about and help innovate over so that we can think, you know, as the horizons of the future come at us, we can continue to evolve with it. So I don't really put much store behind a kind of like, it's a binary choice, it's this or that. Mm-hmm. I think we have to think about it in a much more inclusive and sort of process type of way.
Do you feel like that's one of the reasons why there hasn't been that much wide-scale change, is because people think about it in a binary way?
Well, I mean, I think that one of the problems of the environmental movement is it can operate a bit like a circular firing squad. You know, everybody has different ideas, and they sort of, there can be a tendency to attack other ideas as, are they pure enough? Are they close enough to the momentum? Do they really solve the problem? And if they don't, then there becomes internal fighting around that. That's understandable, right? It's a bunch of people who are super passionate about a big, important issue, and they want to focus on it. I also think, however, that we kind of need to be a bit more expansive in our thinking and incorporate more of that range of solutions so we can all work together. Because honestly, I mean, apart from anything else, it's much more fun, right? It's much more fun when you can... I'm a big believer that the way you solve the world is not with a perfect ideology, it's with momentum. You get up and you get going and you make stuff happen. And if your vision and your ideology isn't quite right, you've got plenty of chances to iterate it and adapt it as you go. But if you say, we've got to get all our ideas right before we start trying to make any change, probably you'll never get going.
No ideology is perfect as well.
No ideology is perfect. Difficult to do. Yes. Speaking as a former Buddhist monk, I can tell you it's difficult.
Oh, really?
It's worth trying for. Yeah.
Oh, we need to know about that story. How did you become a Buddhist monk?
Yes, it doesn't make terribly good stories, because most of the time as a Buddhist monk, you're sort of sitting in the forest on your own. But I'd always wanted to be a monk. And then in my early 20s, I went to Burma and then to Thailand. I spent a few years living in forest monasteries, which was just the most remarkable and wonderful experience. I mean, it's kind of awful when you first arrive, because your mind is used to this train of thoughts and like nice conversations and nice food, etc. And then when all of that stops, it slightly panics. But then if you just stay with it after a while, it kind of calms down. And then you can look and you can see the world around you. And it's a really, really wonderful thing to do. I mean, I know it sounds a bit bizarre in the Western world. In the East, it's much more common for men to ordain for a few years and for women. But it's really been instructive and helpful for me in my life.
How many years?
About 3 years.
Wow. What impact did that have on you? And how you saw the world?
Well, I mean,
it seems like it's been quite formative.
It's been very formative. And, you know, I don't pretend that I still can call on, you know, this was like 15, 16 years ago. I've now got 2 children. I'm working very stressful jobs. You know, it's not that I'm sort of feeling peaceful and meditating all the time. But I think that what it helped me understand in a very formative way at a young age is that things happen and we react to them. And to the casual observer, it seems that the reaction is an inevitable outcome of what happens. Someone shouts at you, you feel upset, you know. If you slow down enough in a monastery, you see that there's a moment of choice and a moment of participation in between those two. And actually, when everyone around you is reacting in a kind of instinctive way, that can become a sort of superpower to enable you to be a bit more selective around how you choose to engage. Now, again, please don't imagine that I am a master at this and I'm capable of doing it at all times. You know, I've got kids and they're screaming
and
breakfast and, you know. But sometimes, yeah. Mm.
It's the awareness of that choice. I think that's more important than perhaps whether you follow it all the time.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. And I think that You know, in the climate movement, what's interesting is that people's mental health is generally quite low. And that's partly a function of the fact that everyone's working on this big overarching problem that probably will never be solved. And, you know, that's not very good for being sort of peaceful and happy with what you're doing. And so actually that makes it even more important to be aware of some of these things and be able to have a participatory relationship with who you are in the world.
Mm. Interestingly enough, on that point, it seems like the book that you wrote with Christiana was very much psychological in its nature, because it was explaining climate change and the issues with climate change and the importance, but it's very much centered on a mindset shift for the individual as the reader, but then also how they can transfer that into their own actions and then into their families and friends and society in general. That psychological shift is the importance on psychology for each one of us to understand how we can actually go about and do this from understanding how we fit into the wider whole. Because I think in the book you said, don't be a consumer, be a citizen. Like, I liked that quote because I thought that's really important, because it's how we fit into the whole.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the truth is that as we go back to that stubborn optimism, which is, you know, part of the mindset shift that we're talking about, whether or not we make this change will be determined in large part by how we show up at this moment, both individually and collectively. Are we capable of meeting the increasing pressure and the increasing emergency of this moment with enough awareness and attention and compassion and calmness to enable us to make the right choices? And there are examples in history of times when actually it's taken that to come to that final moment to then flip. And, you know, it's a classic example, but I kind of like to use it because it's instructive and everyone knows about it. But, you know, in the lead up to the Second World War, if you look back through history, the people of the UK were terrified of Nazi aggression. And they'd sort of do anything to avoid facing it. I mean, the whole appeasement period, you know, there was a really, we sort of brush that off now as a kind of Neville Chamberlain fallacy, but the truth is appeasement was incredibly popular in the UK in the late 1930s. And it was very hard to face, you know, many people lived through the First World War, to face the reality of what was coming next. Now, Churchill is remembered for many things, and there's, and not all of them positive, but he was able, when he came in, to help the country change its attitude towards what was to come. And where before there had been nervousness and fear, there came this kind of calm resolve, right? An island alone, a greatest hour, a greatest generation, a generation that would fight them on the beaches and in the hills and in the streets. And that sort of animated all of their action with meaning. And what it meant was that whether you were then at the front, you stayed home, you were doing dig for victory, everyone was part of this great shared effort. And their lives may have changed fundamentally, or they may not have changed that much at all, but the story changed around the role that they were playing. Now, right now, I mean, you can look at this climate change thing and think, well, everyone's going to sort of like close their borders and go home and protect each other, etc. But it has the makings of a great adventure story, right? I mean, impossible odds, the requirement to come together, an amazing prize that seems beyond our control. If you think of, like, you know, the Joseph Campbell hero's journey, we're at the sort of resisting the call to adventure. But then once you engage in that adventure, and once you say, let's go, let's do it, all manner of things come along to help you. And I just think this is such a privilege. It's so exciting. I still believe that I'm 43 years old, and if I'm lucky enough to live another 40 years, that will be the 2060s. We'll be living in a world that no longer uses fossil fuels. We'll be living in a world where nature has been allowed back into cities and into regions. The world that I remember when I grew up, when you drive through a summer night and the windscreen is covered in bugs because the biodiversity is booming, that could be back by then. It's not here now. And what a journey that will have been on, to have been born like in the 1980s and then die in the 2060s and see that whole arc of change and have created that world for the future. That's how I want to feel when I get to my old age. And that's worth a lot more than anything else I can think of.
So one of the questions that I had, Tom, was regarding misinformation. I think at the moment there seems to be a group of individuals still denying the effects of climate change. And one of the questions I wanted to ask you is, what's the best way for the general population to assess the information that's being given by whether it be multinational organizations and their national governments as well when it comes to the information surrounding climate change?
Yeah, it's a great question. And you know, the prize for sorting this out is bigger than climate change, big as climate change is, right? It's the future of democracy. It's the future of our ability to have a shared basis upon which we can agree what a fact is, which, if you think about it, is actually the basis upon which we can agree to do anything. I mean, if we can't agree how you determine objective truth in anything, then that basically, that's how you undermine the ability of a society to function on any feasible level, right? So this is the critical issue of our time, or it is the means by which we either do or don't facilitate the function in which we can deal with the critical issues of our time. And in many ways, it's the responsibility of all of us, right? I mean, the explosion of data, the explosion of information plays so well into our instincts or our tendencies to look around the world and try and find information that already agrees with our previously held beliefs. And at best, at my most optimistic moments, what I can sort of see is that in order to move through this, we actually need to become more self-reflective, right? And we need to challenge some of those assumptions that we go into things with. The concept of confirmation bias is well established, right? That's the idea that you look around the world for information that confirms your previously held beliefs. And of course, we now have these incredible tools that are basically tools for confirmation bias in the form of social media systems and the internet itself. So I think there's two things. One is we need to be aware of that tendency in ourselves and actually challenge ourselves not to only look out for confirmation bias, but to look for alternative perspectives and to try and keep our minds open, listen to people we're not used to listening to, go to places to get information we're not that used to, try and find that kind of thoughtful polemic and debate that is so missing in society. There's no point in like dwelling around sort of shouty arguments, but actually there is still thoughtful polemic and debate out there if we look for it. And the second thing is, you know, the world is as it's always been in the sense that there are charlatans and there are real thinkers and there is real analysis. And our ability to discern the difference between the two, if we can get past our own confirmation bias, that's not beyond the ability of intelligent human beings, right? There are organizations and individuals set up to profit from misinformation. And there are Royal Academies of Science, and there are, you know, American Academies of Science, and there are institutions that protect process and protect truth. And actually discerning the difference between them, if you spend a few minutes really thinking about it, is not that difficult. Now, it gets more complicated. I'm not diminishing it, because, of course, then you get conspiracy theories that propose that certain fundamental institutions are actually in on some kind of secret, whether it's anti-vax or whatever it may be. Again, this isn't new. The idea of covering up UFOs is sort of, you know, I remember that from when I was a kid. But I think we need to kind of get over that slight adolescent desire to look for sort of an easy fix in the world. I think part of that is also about nostalgia. It's kind of about, we've got a lot of complicated problems and we sort of hope that there's a simple solution. There's a conspiracy theory. There's this problem. There's that problem. Mm-hmm. Oh, there's this little switch down here. And if we just switch it, it will solve all of our problems. Sadly, it's not like that, right? That is an immature response to it. We need to be grown-ups. We need to face the challenging but potentially transformative moment we're in. We need to discern between truth and fiction. And we need to face the truth like the adults that we are at this critical moment. No one else is coming along to do that for us. If we do that, then our challenges are still not beyond our ability to solve.
That's an interesting point you make, because I do think it is some sort of perhaps abdication of responsibility by the individuals, because they're like, oh, well, it's actually not my fault, it's their fault, and they put the blame to something else, and it almost justifies them not doing anything for change. And that's perhaps how I see climate change in particular. It's like, oh, well, I'm denying it based on X reasons, and that means I'm not going to do anything about it.
Well, I think there's something really interesting that's going on between belief, control, and other things in relation to climate change, right? If you think about it, we have equated control with meaning when it comes to climate change. We all hear this from friends or family members. Why do you bother to not fly? Why go vegetarian? The Chinese are building 4 coal-fired power plants a week, whatever the data, right? It sort of tries to say, If you can't control the outcome, then any step you take is completely devoid of meaning. And so therefore, why bother, right? And we quickly devolve to that point. Two things I would say about that. First, That was a deliberate strategy by oil and gas companies to slow progress. That was, and we need to bear that in mind. A lot of money was spent actually trying to persuade people that it's kind of pointless to try and do something about climate change because you can't control the outcome. So we are responding to that interference that happened years ago. That's the first
thing. When did that start?
So that's been going on for a long time. Probably it's not happening in the same way, but that was 90s, 2000s, maybe even before. And that's well documented.
Okay.
The second thing I would say is that in most areas of human endeavor, meaning and control are not correlated. In fact, you can often get more meaning from something that you can't control. Think about a spiritual practice that many people may have, right? That's about letting go into something bigger than yourself. You're not trying to control it from which you derive meaning. Or think about something at the other end of the spectrum. Imagine that you had a sick relative or even a sick child, and you were caring for that child. The amount of meaning that you would get from that action is not related to whether the child gets better or even lives and dies. The meaning is entirely inherent in caring for the child that you love.
Yes.
Right? So to say, is the kid going to get better? No, they might die. Therefore, it's meaningless to try and look after them and care for them. You see the insanity of that argument, right? We are custodians of this planet that is needing our help right now. And to take that effort, big or small, in whatever way makes sense in your life, is among the most meaningful things that we can do as human beings. And we need to get over the idea that it's either meaningful because we have a complete positive outcome or meaningless, you know, on the other end of the spectrum. This is the work we need to be doing.
Part of the reason for that, I think, is just the human nature towards short-term and long-term thinking. Because the thing is most of the work that we will be doing right now to curb climate change, the results really won't be seen probably in our lifetimes.
Not true. So absolutely not true.
You don't think so?
No, absolutely not true. I mean, you know, it will be felt beyond that as well. But yeah, if we all take responsibility to restore nature, to plant trees, all of that will have an impact right now on the biodiversity and the planet that we're experiencing.
So in what respect to it being in our lifetimes?
Well, I mean, you know, many of these different effects that we precipitate on the planet roll through the climate system. And you're right, there's a delay, right? There's a lag. Right now, we're experiencing greenhouse gas emissions that were emitted decades ago. And then the heat, the warming actually takes a while to come through into the system. So it is true that the emissions we're putting up now, we maybe won't feel for a while. Absolutely, that's true. However, the solutions to that, taking action to make our air cleaner, to regenerate nature, to care for other creatures on this planet in a way that befits them rather than treating them appallingly, all of those things will change our world and make it better right at this moment. So we need to keep an eye on both of those things.
What can be done in respect to... So the book's really about having an optimistic view, and I know we talked this previously earlier on in this conversation, but I think it'll be great for... anyone who is listening to this that is wanting to make positive changes and to not have this attitude that you just discussed about having this conflicting thing about if I don't do anything or anything I do is meaningless because X is doing Y and you know, whatever small difference I make, it doesn't make a difference. So what is some of the mindset changes do you think that people can make in order to have that more optimistic mindset towards it?
Well, I think the first thing to say with regard to that is that it's to sort of look at this situation with a lens of optimism can be irresponsible. You know, the truth is that we're at a very perilous moment, and to ignore that would be to ignore our means and our moment for transformation. So what we're not saying is look at the challenge out there and kind of assume that it's going to be great, and then that positive thinking will sort of change the world. What we're saying more is, if you look at this challenging situation and you face it with a kind of gritty determination that something can be done about it, that this can't be beyond our ability to do something, that seed of possibility and transformation is a strategy for changing the world. So it's a very deliberate cultivation of an approach. And if the word stubborn optimism that Christiana and I use doesn't work for some people, that's fine. I mean, I also love what the suffragettes said. They said, courage calls to courage everywhere, right? That if they were brave and if they stood up and they were counted, then actually that would then call to this sense of courage and possibility in other people. That's closer to what we're talking about here. So in that regard, I would say that comes from very clearly and very soberly looking at the situation we're in. And that will lead you to the conclusion that we're right now about to find out if we're serious as humanity about dealing with this issue. And that requires all of us. No one's coming along to do this for us, right? It's going to be us. Either we're going to sort it out or it's not going to happen. And actually, this is going to slip away from us. And it's literally come down to this moment where every day counts. In this next 10 years, we need to reduce emissions by fully 50%, or else we will have lost control of the climatic system for all of the terrible implications that that will have for future generations. So I find that that sense of courage and determined optimism lies on the other side of the kind of grief and sadness that comes from looking at the loss of ecosystems and the degradation of the planet and the degradation of people. To go through that and come back to a determined, stubborn optimism, that's been my journey, and that's what I see has really worked for people. So there has to be an emotional honesty about that. And that's a really critical piece of it. So that's the first thing. Cultivating that as a deliberate, determined strategy, how we show up at this moment, sustains us and gives us an enormous amount of meaning in terms of what we're doing. So that's step one. Step two, the way you keep that going is to take action. If you don't take action, it feels like this big, scary thing that's out there that is beyond your control again. But if you start to do things in your life, you start to eat less meat, you start to transform the way you heat your home, you transform the way you transport yourself, etc., then you start to feel like you're a participant in these things. And in that regard, what we say in the book is what we need to realize is that we tend to overestimate what we can do in a year and underestimate what we can do in 10 years, right? So make a plan to play your role at this critical moment, reduce your emissions by fully 50% by the end of the decade. Actually, with thought and care and planning and determination, that's enough time. You're probably going to change your vehicle. You might change your boiler. That's even enough time to actually think about how you generate revenue in your life and maybe change it for that reason. I mean, Christiana and I run a podcast called Outrage and Optimism because we don't want to have to fly around the world all the time and talk to people about climate change. So now we do it from wherever we are and we put it out on the internet and it's much more effective. So that kind of change, that second piece is also critical. Mm-hmm. And then the third piece, how you show up, reduce your own emissions. The third piece is how you engage with power. We all touch power in all sorts of ways in our lives. We might be, we're a voter, we might have a pension, we're a consumer, we buy goods and services, we're an employee, we might be on a school board, you know, whatever it is, like map out your life. Where do you touch power and how can you use that power to exert influence and direction over all of the institutions that you relate with? Because in doing that as well, we need both, right? We need the individual change. We need the systemic change, the levers of power to actually make things happen. And actually, all of that, you get going on that, you start keeping your eyes on how we can change the world. That is a fantastic range of activities to be engaged in.
Mm. It brings the community aspect to it, which I think is such a huge part of it, because I think any time you want to make any substantial change into your own personal life, I find it much easier when you know that other people are making that change as well.
True. Yeah.
And then you're fitting into somewhat of a global community, which I think one of these, this issue in particular is very much like a global community issue, because you can't see it as, oh, China's doing this, we're doing that, they're different. It's like we're in the same planet, we're in the same boat. One of the things I did want to touch upon was, I know the British government's making a lot of strides, for instance, when it comes to electric cars. And I think the date was 2050, if I remember rightly.
2035, I
think. Is it 2035? Yeah. Okay, then maybe I'm
underestimating. Yeah, no, they keep sharpening it, or it may even be 2030.
Oh,
yeah.
Do you?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, wow. To make sure that there's no new cars that are not electric. How much do you think governments are doing, and do you think they're doing enough in order to tackle this? Because obviously you're very, you have power, I guess, in the sense of your connections in multinational organizations as well and governments. So do you feel like they're doing enough, or what more do you feel like can be done in order to encourage and reduce the level of carbon footprint that the general population has?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. So, I mean, it is 2030. I've just been thinking about it. So it's 2030 is the end date of the internal combustion engine, of internal combustion engine sales in the UK, right? Which is amazing.
It's crazy.
Yeah. By the time my children can drive, they won't be driving an internal combustion engine, which is an astonishing transformation we're living through. So there were two parts to your question. One is, are governments doing enough? The second is, what more can they do?
Yes.
The first part is, Since Paris in 2015, we have seen an amazing stepping up by governments to do more and go faster. I mean, honestly, in the Paris negotiations, the idea that we could hit 2 degrees, let alone 1.5, was beginning to slip away. And in the years since then, what we have seen is an incredible increase of ambition and determination to limit global temperature rise to 1.5 degrees or less. And that's amazing, right? I mean, even at that time when we thought we were going to be seeing a drop of ambition, we've seen an increase of ambition. And that has been at the leader level, the national government level, as well in many cases at the national regulatory level that sits underneath that, not universally. And we need to fill out the regulatory picture around how the big targets are going to be met. But there has been, you know, bringing forward of the end of internal combustion sales. There's been a transformation of how we generate electricity in all sectors of the economy. There's been thinking about the future of domestic heating and cooling. And there's been a lot of different things in the UK and around the world. Is it enough? No, it's not enough. That's the whole issue, right? I mean, what we're seeing is a remarkable and unprecedented transformation of government policy and of economics that is still nowhere near enough to actually get us to where we need to be. And that's sort of a little bit as it was expected. The Paris Agreement was structured so that every few years, when the economics improves, when the technology improves, when public sentiment changes towards stronger and stronger action, then governments progressively step up their levels of commitment in order to get us in line to where we need to be. So we need to keep that pressure up. I mean, in terms of specific examples, we've seen some of this coming out of the G7 recently, but we need to absolutely end coal power now. That is insane that we are still building coal-fired power plants, and we need a proper plan backed by financial instruments to transition away from the existing coal-fired power plants so that coal is gone certainly inside this decade and ideally sooner. The second thing that is a no-brainer right now is we can avoid nearly half a degree of warming by cutting methane leaks, just the leaks, away from oil and gas and in the agricultural sector. Most of that pays for itself. That is a matter of organization and investment and planning. That is an essential piece of work. We need to monitor it and we need to root that out very quickly. It's not very sexy, but it's really, really important. The third thing is the rapid and urgent restoration, regeneration, and protection of nature. Those three things together, that's not the only things we need to do, but right now, if we can do big deals on those three things, they are a big part of what can keep 1.5 degrees alive as we go through the rest of this year, through COP26 and beyond.
Can you talk about methane leaks for a second? So is this related to, for instance, let's say, I know the animal and agriculture industry produces a lot of methane.
Yeah.
Is that the actual product of it, or is it a different type? Because you said methane leak.
So methane leakage of all types, methane leakage from assets. So that could be leakage from pipes. It could be flaring of methane in the oil and gas sector. Okay. It could be leakage from the fracking industry, which has been very infamous for a lot of methane leaks. It's also from animal agriculture. It's the kind of food you feed animals. It's, you know, coming out of animals themselves, whichever end, that all produces methane as well. So both of all of those different elements, I mean, for the agricultural sector, it's more difficult because there's a long tail of participants in that. They're going to need some financial help. But honestly, I mean, oil and gas companies are struggling for their license to operate still at the moment. They should absolutely be stepping up and doing everything they can. But in the end, it's going to have to be regulation, because what we've seen already is that many of the most methane intense assets are being unloaded from the books of the big brand oil and gas companies, the super majors, and they're now owned by small privately held companies who are much less accountable. So regulatory change is the only way we come on top of that. And that has to be everywhere. The US is critical and that's coming forward, but it's also places like Russia and China that need to step up with this as well.
Yeah, the regulation changes, it's related to that supply and demand thing, because if they, for instance, increase, let's say, taxations regarding it, then the market's just going to move, isn't it? It's one of those classic supply and demand things. I think just to end it, Tom, I think one of the things that I got from the book after reading it was that it was very much a call to action for the individual reading it. I think it's very much, okay, what can they do? What plans can they make? What contribution can they make, and also to the people around them? Was that the main takeaway from the book? And perhaps just elaborate on some of the key takeaways, do you think, that the reader, that you wanted the reader to take away from the book?
No, thanks. So I mean, I think the main part from anyone's perspective is the three steps I just laid out: how we show up, how we take responsibility for our own emissions, and then how we engage with power. It's not meant to be. The book is not a sort of description of the fact that we can solve climate change through individual action. Not at all. The reason it's focused on individuals is because individuals read books. I've never seen a corporation reading a book, right? And if you're an individual either running or sitting inside a corporation, then the way you engage with power is a big part of your own strategy to deal with climate change. So we didn't want to write a kind of intellectual abstract book that talks about changes that are necessary in society. We wanted to write a practical book about meeting this moment, about doing what you can, how you can be part of this great shared endeavor to both help people understand how they can participate, but also to help people to realize that it is a great shared endeavor. I mean, where we are right now has all the makings of the most remarkable adventure story, right? I mean, impossible odds, a late hour, disaster if we fail, a new world if we succeed. We should meet this with some of that energy and some of that determination as well. This is a moment that will be looked at and remembered for many, many generations. And the future it will be remembered from is very much in our hands right now. So we need to be aware of that every day, the responsibility of being alive today. And doing that changes how we feel about it and gets us out of our sense of apathy and torpor and depression and focuses us on what can be done now and only now in order to create that future. And that is just the most remarkable way to live your life.
Mm, definitely. That sense of you have a part to play no matter how big or small, and to be a stubborn optimist.
There you go.
I think that's the key of the that's the key message of the book. So thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us, Tom. It's been a pleasure to speak with you regarding your book, The Future We Choose, The Stubborn Optimist Guide to the Climate Crisis. Got it here with your co-author, Christina. Christiana. How do you pronounce it?
Christiana
Figueres. There we go. Yeah. Tom, where's the best place that individuals listening to this can find you and to listen to your own podcast, which was called the...
Ours is called Outrage and Optimism. So yes, find that wherever you find your podcast. Our website is globaloptimism.com. You can find me, Tom Karnak, on Twitter and Instagram and other places. So yeah, thanks so much. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Perfect. Thank you, Tom.
All the best.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. Don't forget to like, share and subscribe for more content. Also, visit our website, www.booktalktoday.com, to subscribe and download the latest edition of our magazine. Join our mailing list to receive the first issue for free to get a taste for the value-packed content that we are offering. Book Talk Today, for readers, by readers.